Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stripinchuk. In this episode, we'll feature a presentation critical of the proposed merger of Comcast and NBC Universal, focusing on the Chicago hearing about the merger, held in July 2010. We'll also hear a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report. But first, a collection of recent news about media and democracy from the show Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
Over the last few weeks in Egypt, a million people have taken to the streets to call for democratic reform. The Egyptian government responded by cutting off internet and most cell phone access, plunging the nation into digital darkness. As more people turned to their cell phones, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube to speak out for their human rights, cutting off internet and mobile access is a new way for governments to crack down on popular political uprising. Could someone in the United States flip an internet kill switch? There is cause for concern. Senators Joe Lieberman, Susan Collins, and Thomas Carper introduced legislation in the last Congress that would give the president and the executive branch authority to cut off critical infrastructure in times of crisis. A report from Wired said that Senator Collins would reintroduce the Protect Cyberspace as a National Asset Act in this Congress. The 2010 bill said that the federal government's designation of vital internet or other computer systems, quote, shall not be subject to judicial review. Timothy Carr, campaign director of Free Press, says that if the bill was reintroduced, Congress would need to seriously address its vague language and failure to establish effective checks and balances over the executive branch.
We're very concerned that should it go forward in this Congress, they need to seriously address the language within the bill that appears to give the executive branch this overriding authority. I think there are profound First Amendment issues when you allow the executive branch the power to cut off critical infrastructure. The internet is not just critical infrastructure, it's a critical social infrastructure. It is, in the 21st century, a means by which people express themselves freely.
Carr says we have to treat open networks as fundamental to a functioning democracy.
Now, given what we saw happen last week and this week in Egypt, efforts to cut off the internet are not a good thing. If a nation tries to disable its citizens' ability to speak freely, to organize and communicate with others, it really has the potential of being a gross violation of not only our right to communicate, but our human rights as well.
Last weekend, White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs said that he believes internet access and the right to social network is a fundamental and basic individual right.
So if the White House really feels that way, they have to hold to that commitment. If internet access is a basic right, if the right to open networks and social networking is a basic right, then they need to oppose the language in this legislation that gives them the power to take that away.
People in Sibley and Renville counties in Minnesota just want broadband. Yet the phone and cable companies there, including Frontier Communications, have failed to connect people to high-speed internet. And hundreds of homes are stuck with slow dial-up, spotty satellite, or no internet at all. So the counties decided to do it themselves and just finished a feasibility study to build its own fiber-to-the-home network. But like every comfortable service provider about to face new competition, Frontier is pushing back against the project. The company sent a letter to Sibley County commissioners recounting other municipal broadband efforts that have struggled and is cautioning the county to rethink its efforts. Mark Erickson is a Winthrop City administrator who has spearheaded the Fiber to the Home project. He says Frontier is trying to stop the competition at any cost.
They just want to throw fear and doubt into the equation. They want to obfuscate all the issues. They want to make people think that it's Ma Bell. They know how to do these things, and municipals certainly can't.
But while Frontier doesn't want the municipality to build the network, they certainly don't want to do it themselves either, and neither do other providers. Erickson says the counties are willing to work with the companies and even help finance the network, but no one is biting.
We actually have sat down and said, please work with us. But they just haven't gotten over that hump, I guess, of wanting to work with municipals. They see us too much as the enemy and not the partner.
Erickson said he isn't daunted by Frontier's fear tactics. Instead, he's spending his time rallying local folks behind a project he says will revitalize rural America.
Well, I drove up to the county to the west last week, and I was driving along and looking at all these farm sites that dot the frozen tundra up here. What's this network going to do for them? It's going to make every one of those farmhouses relevant again. They're going to be connected to the world. They can take Chinese lessons with high-definition video real-time with folks in China, because they'll have 20 megs up and 20 megs down to their home for $42 a month. Those are the kinds of things that this network will allow people to do, and I'm really excited about it.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
And now, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
It's time to grab the mic. This year, 2011, is the time, perhaps the last time, that community and not-for-profit groups, labor unions, sororities, musicians, and promoters, and would-be newsmakers will have to grab their own places on the FM radio dial in cities and towns across the U.S., thanks to the Community Low Power Radio Act. Passed and signed into law after more than a decade of stubborn community organizing and persistent lobbying, the Community Low Power Radio Act allows the FCC to grant broadcast licenses to not-for-profit organizations on the third adjacent and, in some cases, the second adjacent spot on the radio dial between existing full-power commercial radio stations. These new low-power FM radio stations will broadcast at about 100 watts, giving them roughly a 7-mile broadcast radius, a circle 14 miles across. In small and medium cities, that's a significant audience. In major metropolitan areas, it can be a vast audience. The licensing window is expected to open late this year, so the time to begin researching and preparing your license application is now. How important is this? Without control over some kind of mass media, without the ability to speak with and to hear its own voices, communities simply do not exist. Musicians and producers today cannot break into commercial radio playlists without big sponsorships or million-dollar bribes. Not-for-profit, low-power radio will enable musicians, clubs, and producers to be heard in the areas where they actually live and work. Not-for-profit, low-power radio sets DJs and MCs free to play the music they and their audiences like, instead of what some national broadcaster or sponsor demands. And most of all, not-for-profit, low-power radio empowers local newsmakers, local forces for peace and justice, to produce their own programming and speak to their own neighbors. Low Power Radio lets your neighbors lift up and share their own concerns over those of corporate-endorsed experts and celebrities. What will happen if responsible, organized local forces fail to take advantage of this low-power opening? The last time a licensing window opened up, a handful of ruthless and backward-looking right-wing evangelical broadcasters applied for thousands of licenses across the country in order to place repeaters or translator units that pulled down the same programming to thousands of locations nationwide. In the next few weeks, the FCC will begin a rulemaking process to sketch out the guidelines under which license applications will be considered. The rulemaking process is not likely to last more than 6 months, and at its end, there will be a 30-day period in which license applications will be accepted. Then the window will close, perhaps forever. If you want to be heard, if you want your community to hear its own voice on the FM radio dial, this will be your last chance. For more information, contact the Prometheus Radio Project online at www.prometheusradio.net. Prometheus will be monitoring the rulemaking process as it unfolds and can guide your local organization in the successful completion of a broadcast license application. Visit the Low Power FM radio page at blackagendareport.com, where we will print updates every 2 weeks on the rulemaking and applications processes with guides, tips, and resources for how your local not-for-profit organization can grab the mic. Without some control over mass media, communities do not exist. So let's grab that mic. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Bruce Dixon. Find us on the web at www.blackagendareport.com and at blackagendareport.com/lowpowerfmradio.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchik. We now feature a presentation critical of the proposed merger of Comcast and NBC Universal, focusing on a Chicago hearing about the merger held in July 2010. This is a reading of a report written and researched for Chicago Media Action, posted online on November 15, 2010.
The trend of increasing concentration of media ownership in the major U.S. media in recent decades is well documented, as are the negative impacts stemming from such concentration, such as more commercialism, less localism, less quality journalism, less diversity, fewer diverse perspectives, and layoffs of media producers. The reason for such concentration stems from the increasing profit mandates of these media companies, some of them the largest corporations on earth, coupled with a federal policy apparatus long dominated by a markets-know-best ethos and by a proverbial personnel water slide, where policymakers invariably leave government to join the very industry they previously regulated to assume influential and highly paid positions. But in recent years, concentrated media has become a thinkable issue, even though the major U.S. media have seldom actually covered the political debates about themselves for these same institutional reasons. Even less covered by major media have been the efforts of political activists working on U.S. media policy, grouped under such rubrics as media justice, media democracy, or more broadly, media activism, who actually made media concentration a thinkable issue. Yet it can be shown that the long and tireless efforts of these political activists have resulted in some dramatic victories in halting the worst trends of media concentration since 2003. To improve their efforts further, these media policy activists and the groups comprising them, many of whom had collaborated on a loose and informal basis, began to formalize to some extent in such coalitions as the Media and Democracy Coalition, or MADCO, and the Media Action Grassroots Network, or MAGNET. These coalitions, and indeed anyone who enters the sphere of media policy work from a public interest view in addressing media concentration, invariably face a key question that evokes the paradoxes of the ancient Greek philosopher Zeno of Elea. How do you talk about the media without using the media? That is, with the major media holding the main means of public awareness on issues, and with the major media also refusing to cover themselves to protect their own interest, how is public awareness achieved, especially where public awareness has been critical for building public support, involvement, and constructive action? One answer to that is and has been to use every tactic at your disposal, and so a variety of tactics, everything from distributing songs to organizing street protests to writing critical op-eds in newspapers that will allow them, to using the internet in forms from email to social networking, have been deployed to get the word out to build that needed public awareness and support. One key tactic has been the establishment and use of in-person public fora about media concentration in cities across the United States. In the months preceding the dramatic win to halt the FCC's 2003 round of media concentration, a number of organized fora, mostly unofficial, served a critical role in reaching sympathetic media, rallying and demonstrating public support, building and strengthening connections among activists, and exposing the hypocrisy and bankruptcy of the corporate media's positions and arguments. The city of Chicago, with its size and its position outside the major media policy centers of New York and Washington, has served as a frequent locale of such fora, including the 2003 unofficial Midwest Forum on Media Ownership, the 2007 official FCC Forum on the Quadrennial Media Ownership Review, and, the focus of this presentation, the 2010 public forum to discuss the proposed Comcast-NBC Universal-General Electric joint venture. As of 2010, Comcast ranked among all U.S. companies as the largest cable television company, the largest broadband internet company, the third largest telephone services company, and among the largest overall media companies. Comcast has long had an eye to enter into new media realms, offering a bid in 2004 to purchase Disney, which Disney rejected. In the summer of 2009, the media business press was abuzz with speculation that Comcast sought to buy a majority stake in the NBC Universal media conglomerate from its current corporate owner, General Electric. Such a merger would mark an unprecedented consolidation of broadcast television, movie production, music distribution, cable television distribution and production, broadband internet, and telephone service under a single corporate roof, with potentially grave ramifications on media concentration, network neutrality, journalism, public access television, labor and layoffs, communities of color, and even the very future of broadcast television, among many other concerns. The antitrust potential of the Comcast-NBC joint venture was even described by one analyst as ranking a, quote, 10 out of 10, unquote. With such enormous stakes, the proposed merger received ostensible scrutiny among a number of government bodies, the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, the Department of Justice, and two committees in the U.S. House of Representatives, Judiciary and Energy and Commerce. The House committees held public hearings outside of Washington on the proposed merger, one by Judiciary in Los Angeles, June 7th, and another by Energy and Commerce in Chicago on July 8th. Reports of the Los Angeles hearing focused predominantly on criticisms leveled against Comcast. The Chicago hearing also saw some criticism voiced of Comcast and NBC Universal, but that criticism focused almost exclusively on the paucity of communities of color in Comcast's and NBC Universal's hiring practices, upper-level management, and television programming. The 90-minute-long Chicago hearing allotted no time for public comment, and the one person who tried to interject comments during that hearing was dismissed by hearing chair Rick Boucher, Democrat of Virginia. The public was offered a chance to comment for the record on the proposed merger 5 days later and 10 blocks away when the FCC held a public event on the proposed merger at Northwestern University Law School. That the event took place at all was remarkable. In the past, most mergers simply received approval without any noticeable public debate or discussion. This is not to say that such debate or discussion is sufficient to derail a proposed merger, but it is certainly necessary. While the deck was stacked decidedly for Comcast and NBC Universal in the Chicago House Committee hearing, the two panels of commentators convened by the FCC were decidedly more critical, so much so that one headline recounting the hearing read, "Critics dominate latest hearing on Comcast-NBC merger." The FCC opened a two-hour public comment period where anyone could sign up and offer up to 2 minutes of commentary about the proposed merger to be included in the docket on consideration of the merger. Both pro-merger efforts and media democracy efforts staked a claim during this public comment period. The comments at this particular hearing carry potentially tremendous weight, given the fate of the proposed Comcast-NBC Universal merger and what doors may open or close thereafter for other possible mergers. And that this Chicago FCC event on the proposed Comcast-NBC merger could well be the only such public event organized by FCC staff on the matter. It can thus be argued that an analysis of those comments is critical for current and future media mergers and the future of the American media environment on the whole. And so we devote the balance of this presentation to provide such an analysis. Although the public comment period was scheduled to run for 2 hours, the FCC, to its credit, extended the time for the period to allow everyone who signed up to enter comments on the record, even though that time range lasted longer than the originally scheduled 2 hours. In all, 69 individuals testified during the public comment period. Chicago Media Action, CMA, created a database after reviewing the full video of the comments posted on the FCC's website at reboot.fcc.gov/video-archives. The CMA database gathered a number of metrics about the speakers, including the stated name of each speaker, the stated organizational affiliation, if any, of each speaker, whether the speaker can be reasonably construed to speak in favor of or against the proposed merger, some reasonably construed demographic data of each speaker, including sex and race, the stated locale of each speaker, if any, and whether or not applause was heard after each commenter's testimony. The full database is presented as a Microsoft Excel spreadsheet separate of this presentation. Portions of the database are included in the report, and the report itself is online at www.chicagomediaaction.org, as is the full database in a Microsoft Excel spreadsheet. We also note that even though the event was about the proposed merger of Comcast and NBC Universal, NBC Universal was seldom mentioned in the comment period. This is understandable given Comcast's greater financial position and since Comcast stands to be the main owner in the proposed merger. Thus, we focus our analysis on Comcast as the main actor here. Of the 69 speakers who testified, 35 offered clear praise of Comcast. Those 35 people can be grouped as follows. 29 representatives of various nonprofit organizations. 2 representatives of various for-profit companies. 2 Comcast employees. And 2 representatives of area government entities. One might suppose that with slightly more than half of all public speakers praising Comcast, that the audience would hear ample rationale why the proposed merger is a good thing and should go forward. Quite the contrary. Not one of those 35 speakers posited even a single explicit reason in favor of the proposed merger on grounds of the merger per se. What's more, of those 35 speakers, only 8 people even mentioned the proposed Comcast-NBC merger in any form. Fundamentally, the only reason offered by these 35 speakers, if it even merits being called a reason, can be summarized with the following syllogism. 1. Comcast does all these good things for us. 2. Therefore, Comcast is good. 3. Therefore, Comcast's proposed buyout of NBC Universal is good. The 29 representatives of various nonprofit organizations who praise Comcast span the gamut of various social service organizations, working on issues like LGBT rights, education, therapy, the environment, and even a public access television channel in Naperville, Illinois. A critical observer of this scene might be inclined to think that the praise is simply a smokescreen to make Comcast seem like a model corporate citizen. After all, if a person is on trial for a crime, the question of the guilt of the accused is the matter at issue. Speaking about the good works of the accused is avoiding the issue of the guilt of the accused, and no court worth its salt would tolerate such discursions. And yet, it seems that efforts in praise of Comcast during the public comment period consisted of nothing but such discursions. There is some indication that the establishment of a smokescreen was the whole point of their presence at the hearing. One of the 35 speakers, Michael Evans, speaker number 39, said that their whole purpose was to talk about how great Comcast is. Quote, "We're here today not to discuss the creation of a media conglomerate, rather the collaboration of investment and interest," unquote. It bears repeating that such remarks are blatantly disingenuous. The whole point of the July 13, 2010 FCC event is to talk about media mergers, specifically the proposed merger of Comcast and NBC Universal. And anything else either misses the point or deliberately avoids the point, neither of which is a vote of confidence for those who spoke in praise of Comcast. While the Comcast 35 could not muster a single valid reason to support the proposed merger, the remaining 34 speakers raised a wide variety of issues and concerns related to the proposed merger, including the following. The massive scale of the proposed merger. The likelihood of layoffs and anti-labor tactics. The fear of an insufficient number of federal hearings and a call for more hearings. The threat of increasing media concentration that could be opened if the merger proceeds. Calls for the divestiture of the television network Telemundo amidst such a threat of concentration. Concern about the future of public access, education, and government cable television, or PEG, in the wake of the proposed merger. The possibility of Comcast gutting MSNBC as a resource of non-right-wing reporting and opinion. The future, or lack thereof, of network neutrality. The future, or lack thereof, of First Amendment rights on the Internet. The cementing of corporate power in American life. The reduction of diversity in media. Comcast's previously dismal record on consumer rights and media issues. Those who raised concerns of the merger were not as neatly delimited as those who praised Comcast. Critics included media democracy activists both aligned with media activist groups and not aligned with media activist groups, community media producers in radio and television, a host of public access television programmers, representatives from nonprofit organizations, students and educators, one gentleman who complained of a land dispute with Comcast, a variety of concerned individuals, and even some in the media, including one gentleman who identified himself solely as a, quote, worker in the industry, unquote, and did not give his name. Encouragingly, some of those critical of the proposed merger recognized the apparent smokescreen and called it out amidst the comments. Laura Chamberlain, speaker number 29, explicitly called out Comcast near the end of her remarks to say, quote, "Is Comcast a social service agency?" unquote. and Claire Tobin, speaker number 50, began her remarks to say that Comcast's social service work is irrelevant to the question of the proposed merger of Comcast and NBC Universal. There was one other metric of note: whether or not speakers received any applause during or after their remarks. By our count, 19 speakers received applause from the audience that was recorded on the FCC video. All 19 of those speakers were critical of the merger. Not one person who praised Comcast received any audible applause, even from others who also praised Comcast. Even a cursory review of the FCC's history demonstrates its long-standing willingness to serve as a handmaiden of big corporate media. The July 13th event, despite its noteworthiness, provides little in the way to change this overall trajectory. The event was not an official FCC forum. Otherwise, all five sitting FCC commissioners would be required to attend, and only one commissioner, Michael Copps, actually did attend. But official forums are only one variable in the trajectory of our media, and it bears noting that progress on media policy often happens in spite of the FCC rather than because of it. The proposed merger of Comcast and NBC Universal is no different. The common opinion among many analysts, and even among Comcast officers in public interviews, is that the proposed merger of Comcast and NBC Universal will gain approval from the FCC and all other requisite government agencies after a year or so of review, and perhaps with one or more conditions. Such conditions may include a divestiture of one or more cable channels, for example CNBC or Telemundo, a temporary commitment to one or more socially beneficent policies, for example requiring Comcast to abide by network neutrality policies for 2 years, or any of a number of permanent requirements, for example keeping to diversity mandates, or a requirement that Comcast not close down any NBC broadcasting affiliates. Other outside proposals, such as that offered by the Writers Guild of America East, who have asked for a $100 million set-aside for public affairs programming as a condition of the proposed merger, may also affect the negotiations. But even if FCC and other government approval of the proposed merger is likely, there are any of a number of additional ways in which the merger could fail or be blocked. Comcast could call off the merger if one or more conditions are connected to the proposed merger that Comcast deems undesirable and is unable to remove or ignore. If the raft of government agencies addressing the merger take a long time to resolve out the many antitrust questions related to the merger, a block of Comcast shareholders could get cold feet over the amount of time spent on the merger and demand that the merger be called off. And there's still the possibility that an outside lawsuit can still scuttle the merger or hobble it enough for Comcast to call it off. The hearings, especially FCC-organized events, play a special role in that the comments heard there can serve as grist for lawsuits against the FCC and others, which can affect particular actions in the media that result. Thus, it is important to organize, outreach, encourage people to attend, and encourage people to testify for the record, particularly when the opposition will be there and will deliver a smokescreen of non-responses.
That was a reading of a report written and researched for Chicago Media Action, posted online on November 15, 2010. The full report is online at the Chicago Media Action website at www.chicagomediaaction.org. Since the report's release, the FCC and the Department of Justice have approved the Comcast-NBC Universal joint venture, but many have raised questions about whether or not that merger will succeed in whatever sense. That remains to be seen.
Listen to all past episodes of the Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of the Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.